Good afternoon. This is Linda Galash, and you're listening to the December 9th, 2011 edition of Catalyst Radio, the weekly public affairs radio program of Community Media Center focusing on local efforts. CMC's Catalyst Radio brings you interviews with organizations and people working on social change, community support, and media issues. During the month of December, Catalyst Radio is undergoing subtle changes in its format, and among those changes is the allowance for longer interview segments. The format allows for us to go a bit deeper into local community affairs. We will also check in on our online citizen journalism project, The Rapidian. There we will examine community conversations being discussed. We will continue our media literacy efforts, looking at the state of media and effects of free speech as well. Listen for the fully reformed Catalyst Radio beginning January 2012. And today we do take advantage of that longer interview format. We spend the show with in-studio guest, national journalist Carrie Elleville. We sat down recently with Elleville while she was back in her hometown. She was the featured speaker at a number of events in the area, including the keynote for the local Progressive Women's Alliance. Well, today on Catalyst Radio, we welcome to the studio Carrie Elleville, national journalist, but originally hailing from the Grand Rapids area. Carrie, welcome back to town.
Thanks for having me, Linda.
Well, we've just said that you're a national journalist, and you've actually come to the area over the past several days to talk about some issues here in the area. Talk a little bit about your career that brings you back in Grand Rapids.
Wow, that's a long and winding path. I will say, you know, I started out, I've been a journalist for about 15 years now. I started out sort of as a mainstream journalist. I mean, niche, I worked in business journals. But in 2005, 2006, I found myself in New York City and I started covering issues for the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender community. And I was in, you know, New York City. I was at a local paper and that's where I started covering LGBT issues. And after I did that for about a year, I had an opportunity to join The Advocate, which is a national LGBT publication, and I was covering at that point the primary between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. So that was a huge opportunity for me to go from covering city and state politics in New York to go to be covering this incredible barn burner of a primary and then the general election. And then I ended up, of course, moving from New York to Washington to cover the White House for the first 2 years of the Obama administration. And that was also a real thrill. I pitched doing that. We did not have a Washington correspondent. And so I got my CEO at a holiday party and he had a drink or two in him.
Opportune moment.
And I said, you know, wouldn't it be great for us to have a Washington correspondent? And he could see it. He saw, you know, he saw the opportunity there. And before you knew it, I was in Washington. So then I spent 2 years covering the Obama administration in Washington.
Was this unique that there was actually a correspondent at the National Press Corps?
You are exactly right, Linda. You know, at that point, like there had been, first of all, there are definitely gay and lesbian reporters in that briefing room. But one of the things was that there had never been a reporter for an LGBT outlet on a regular basis going to the briefing room. So where some people from the LGBT press had been credentialed before, no one had been consistently asking questions of a White House press secretary. So that was completely new, and I sort of carved out a niche in there for that. It was really interesting to be doing that. I mean, of course, the first time I asked a question, my heart was in my throat and I nearly messed it up. I remember I asked a question about the Defense of Marriage Act, which, of course, is a law that prevents same-sex couples who are legally married, even if they're legally married in their state, from getting federal recognition for that marriage, right? So I asked about DOMA, as it's called, and I remember saying something like the president supported DOMA during his campaign, and then what I was really meant to say was the repeal of DOMA during his campaign, and so I corrected myself, and Robert Gibbs, you know, sort of dodged that question, as he did many of my questions, but he did that across the board. He dodged questions across the board.
It didn't matter the issue.
No, it didn't matter the issue. He wasn't big on answers. That was his style, so anyway.
Okay, well, that took you to D.C. Are you still in Washington, D.C. at this point?
You know, I am. I don't know how much longer I'll be there. At the outset of next year, I plan to start working full-time, at least for several months, on a book. about that period in gay rights history. And there were a lot of the fact that Don't Ask, Don't Tell repeal passed, which was really, I mean, hate crimes also passed. There was hate crimes legislation, right, that was pro-LGBT. But hate crimes and Don't Ask, Don't Tell, it was sort of a bigger, for the community, that was a bigger piece of legislation to undo that very, you know, discriminatory, pernicious policy that
was
for the military.
Let's talk a little bit about that history, because when it was originally passed, mm-hmm. it was almost looked at as somewhat progressive at that moment based on where things were, but then really was a problem to serve in the military at that point.
It ended up becoming, I don't think, you know, it's hard to know exactly how it was intended. I'm sure it was intended when it was passed by different people, had different intentions, right?
Sure.
But the way it ended up being implemented and administered was that it essentially became a witch hunt for people who were gay. So the policy is sort of a misnomer. It sounds like, you know, you don't get asked and you don't tell. But in fact, investigations would be launched for people who didn't tell. Maybe someone found out or saw them at a bar somewhere or saw them with, you know, in some public place with their, you know, with the person they were dating or their partner. And then they would get essentially outed. And depending on who the commander was, the person in charge, an investigation might be launched. Now, some commanders look the other way. Others, you might find your personal email being accessed in order to figure out whether or not you were gay or lesbian. So it did not turn out, I think, as planned by some people in the way that it was administered.
And the year it was passed?
1993.
Okay.
1993, and I think it went into effect in 1994. So this, there had never been a major piece of pro-LGBT, pro-gay legislation passed going into the 111th Congress that at the outset of President Obama's term. So we, you know, the LGBT community was really hungry to see some gains, and it was a huge deal to have Don't Ask, Don't Tell repeal passed. And, you know, we came within a hair's breadth of losing that, but eked it out in the last few days of the congressional session. If it hadn't happened in those last few days, it never would have happened in this congressional session. There's going to be no pro-LGBT legislation going through.
And the date this one was repealed, what was that?
I think it was September 20th that it was finally certified. They passed the law to repeal it, you know, last year, but they didn't actually certify the repeal, meaning the ban was still in effect, right? The possibility to be discharged for being gay or lesbian was still in effect up to, I think, September 20th of this year.
Okay. So you're in town to actually talk a little bit about your war story, so to speak, of,
yes.
of that whole political
Fair
process
enough.
And you're covering it. You were in town speaking in a couple different places or in West Michigan. Talk about what you said to the audiences.
Yeah, well, so, you know, I spoke to some different audiences. I spoke to in Ann Arbor to some student groups, one journalism class in Ann Arbor, and then an LGBT student group there. And then I also, you know, I was here on behalf of the Progressive Women's Alliance. They brought me in to give these speeches and then set up a, you know, a number of them. And I was also in Holland. I talked to a progressive group there, and as well as another progressive group in Ann Arbor. So, and then I, you know, of course, gave my keynote address. So I made five speeches overall. They all were tailored slightly differently to the audience. But there were a couple themes that I hit on no matter what. One was that this year in history, when Don't Ask, Don't Tell repeal was passed, the Obama administration stopped defending the Defense of Marriage Act as constitutional, which doesn't mean it ends it, but it's this beginning of the dismantling of that law, I believe. And then New York passed same-sex marriage, which doubled the number of people in the nation who are covered by marriage equality laws. So those three things taken together, I think, will be seen as a watershed moment in history for the LGBT movement. Another thing I always hit on with these audiences, you know, I will walk away from Washington whenever that is, which I don't know exactly when it is, but I think relatively cynical about Washington as a, you know, a place where things can actually be accomplished. It was not easy to get the repeal through. The revisionist history, as I sometimes mention, is that, it, you know, like I said, is that everyone knew it was going to happen and it all went according to plan. And it did not. It took a lot of individual activism. And most of that activism came from people outside of Washington, Washington outsiders. I mean, I sort of consider myself still a Washington outsider. I just happened to live in the belly of the beast for 2.5 years. So one thing I always tell people is that individual acts of activism matter, and sometimes they don't make the difference on their own, but taken collectively with other people's individual act of activism, they add up to something. And every one of us has the power to engage in that. You know, there were people who protested on behalf of Don't Ask, Don't Tell that helped create pressure on the administration and on politicians in Washington to get this thing done. Me being in the briefing room in some ways was an individual act of activism. Making Robert Gibbs choose every time I was in there whether or not he was going to take an LGBT question that day was a way for him to be reminded that there was this entire constituency that had voted for them, donated to them, pamphleted, canvassed on their behalf, and poured their hearts into getting Obama elected. And that constituency was typically forgotten as soon as the votes were counted. So I was a constant reminder to the administration in that way.
Okay. Well, just to remind listeners, we're visiting with national journalist Carrie Ellevelde. She's back in town, back where she started, actually. And this is Catalyst Radio on 88.1 FM WYCE. Carrie, you're talking a little bit about your experience covering the LGBT issues and specifically the Don't Ask, Don't Tell repeal. You also mentioned individual activism. So do you draw a line or do you see a merging of things when you talk about being a journalist and then some individual activism of you just being there, being an active individual activism?
Are you talking about this balance between activism and journalism?
Exactly.
Yeah, okay. Well, you know, that was tough for me to bridge. I will say, so when I started out covering LGBT issues, like I said, in 2006, I sort of considered myself to be just a journalist who was covering a gay beat. That's what I thought. What happened was, is in the course of doing that, that there was a decision from the high court in New York that found that gays and lesbians, same-sex couples, did not have the right, the constitutional right, to marry in that state. Like any good journalist, I spent the entire day on sort of a adrenaline high, you know, trying to absorb whatever hundred number of pages that decision was, talking to experts so they could give me insights about it, trying to get reactions from the community. We put the paper to bed that night, and I woke up that Friday morning, which was sort of a down day for us, and I had this realization, which comes with a little bit of the privilege of having been, you know, a white person raised in a middle-class household in the Midwest, that this had never occurred to me before, but I had this realization that I was truly a second-class citizen. It wasn't hypothetical that I might have trouble getting married anymore. In the state where I lived, some 80-year-old guy with a pen had decided that my love didn't equal his and that I wasn't, my heart didn't beat the same and it wasn't as important and I couldn't get married. So it was that point at which I started to make this evolution, I would say, from journalist to activist. It was a long period of time, but I would say by the time I left the briefing room in the White House, because I'm no longer in there, you know, I was sort of a wholehearted activist at that point. And that line was hard to walk at certain points, but there came a time in toward the end of 2009 when I looked back on the year over the holidays and said there haven't been hardly any gains on LGBT rights at this point. You know, I don't want to walk away from this job in a year, because I knew at the midterms anything that wasn't passed before the end of the year in 2010 wasn't going to get passed. The one of the chambers was clearly going to switch over to Republican control, and nothing pro-LGBT could be expected to get through at that point. So I had this point where I thought, I don't want to walk away from this job thinking, what if I had done such and such? What if I'd pushed harder? What if some of the columns that I wrote had been a little bit more pointed? I just wanted to walk away knowing I had done everything I could to inform the constituency that I was writing for, which was most important to me. And, you know, I feel incredibly gratified at the outcome, which I've up until the very last minute never expected. And, you know, and just happy that I was in the position to do what I did and that I did the best I could do at it while I was there.
You're talking a little bit about leaving D.C. What is next for you? You still have activist interest? Is that the path you're going now?
I've spent the last year working as a senior fellow for EqualityMatters.org, and that's an LGBT, and it's a website that's dedicated to full LGBT equality. At the end of the year, I'm going to wrap that up, and I think I mentioned earlier, at the beginning of next year, I'm going to start working on a book. I've already started working on it, actually, but I'm going to take the first several months of next year to sort of work on that full time. And what I hope to convey, along with some of the atmosphere surrounding this historic time period for LGBT equality, are some of the lessons that people can take away from what activists did in order to get things done.
So do you believe that this issue is sort of a template as to what can be done in other areas?
I will tell you, absolutely. There are people who sometimes now in Washington, and they have to be fairly progressive thinkers, because there's a whole group of people in Washington, right, who just prefer the status quo, and they would like to believe that these protests and that some of the things that people did, some of the things that I did, you know, didn't make all that big a difference. I wholeheartedly disagree with that. I think they made a huge difference. I think they heightened the sense of urgency of the administration, of the lawmakers. There were heroes all the way around at different points. It was no one thing that did it. But without this piece of activism that came largely from outside Washington, I just really believe that the urgency would not have been heightened to the point that they would move up their timeline. Their timeline was not to get this done in 2010. I mean, their timeline, though not explicitly stated, was at least at the outset of 2009 to, at the very least, wait until 2011. That moved up based on the political actions that were taken. So I do think that there are lessons to be learned for the greater progressive constituency when you look at reproductive rights advocates, immigration activists, labor, environmentalists, and LGBT folks, which essentially create sort of the broader spectrum of the progressive community. We were the only group to get a piece of major federal legislation passed. The only group. And some groups now are looking at us, even in Washington, and I say the more progressively minded folks, have sought out advice from us on what we did, on what kind of things. And if you want to see a big win that just happened for environmentalists, and these were some folks that we were in contact with, and don't get me wrong, they did all this on themselves, but they did seek out some advice on messaging and things like that from people who were involved in the LGBT effort on Don't Ask, Don't Tell. They just got the administration to delay their decision on whether or not to allow the Keystone XL pipeline, pipe this very dirty type of oil down from Canada through to the Gulf of Mexico over U.S. soil.
And that was going to hit some sensitive areas in
Nebraska. In Nebraska. There's a main aquifer there that provides fresh water to a bunch of western states as well as Nebraska. So if there was any leakage from that, and there have already been leaks in the first portions of the pipeline that have already been built and gone into effect. So if there was any leakage from that into that aquifer, I mean, you know, we forget this in places like Michigan, but I lived in California for a while. Water is a real problem there. There's not enough water to go around. And so many of the political battles out there are fought around water distribution and who owns the right to the water. So that was a huge deal there. They protested during the last 2 weeks of August, approximately. They had 2,000 people come in to get arrested in front of the White House. Peaceful, lawful protests. They did sit-ins in front of the White House, about 45 to 60 people a day. They did that. That was a huge number of people to have get arrested over the course of 2 weeks. And these were from all over. I went to some of the protests. These were, you know, younger activists, and then they were older, oftentimes women and sometimes men, but between the ages of like 50 and 65, a really diverse group of people. And then just about a week ago, last weekend, yeah, something like that. Anyway,
recently, just
about a week ago, they formed a perimeter around the White House, people holding hands, and they ended up having about 10,000 people there, and the perimeter was about 2 to 3 people deep. So this was a huge expression on the part of the environmentalists that this was a big decision. They didn't want the Obama administration to sort of bow to oil interests, to big oil, and you know they wanted him to make good on some of his promises to the environmental community after the climate bill died without a fight, pretty much, in the 111th Congress. And what the administration did was said, we're going to study this some more, the State Department's going to study this some more, and we're going to get back to it after the elections in 2012, which essentially means we're kicking the can down the road here. We don't want to make this decision before the elections because we don't want to upset part of our base, the environmentalists. We also don't want to upset the business interests. So let's take it out of that time frame and move it to, you know, 2013.
So in this case, a delay is helpful versus getting a repeal, not so helpful.
Right. Mm-hmm. In this case, that's an initial win for the environmentalists because without all that activism, I'm quite certain that it would have just gone through. The president would have signed the piece of paper that he had to sign in order to approve that pipeline, and it would have just gone through, probably.
we've got so much to talk about, and with just about 5 minutes to go, I wanted to kind of bring it back to journalism itself. You're writing a book that's a little bit about that experience of your 2 years at the White House, and you're kind of moving a little bit from journalism, but I just want to ask you, you've been on the national scene as far as journalism goes, but I'm sure it comes down to this, the local level too. What are you seeing in the landscape of journalism these days? We know locally that there's been a condensing of what's available, but what are you seeing?
Well, journalism's, I mean, it's such a broad subject and there's so much change going on. And I don't like all the changes that are taking place for sure. I mean, you know, it's become this 24-hour barrage of stuff. I mean, one of the reasons I got out of it was because I didn't want to do breaking news anymore. And while that can be thrilling in your 20s and 30s, when you hit 40, it starts to be a drag. For some people, it starts to be a drag even earlier than that. But if I got a piece of information at 11 o'clock at night and I didn't write it up, I didn't make a few phone calls on it and write it up right then, someone else was going to have written it by 5 in the morning. So, it's constant like that. It doesn't matter whether it is Monday or Saturday. It's constant like that. So it is a particularly difficult profession in a lot of ways. The truth is never easy to actually find. Having said that, I've become a firm believer after watching Washington that without journalists, and journalists really get a bad rap. We're not perfect. And some journalists are better than others and some are more ethical than others. But without journalists at least making an attempt to shed light on what's actually happening in Washington or in any political system, be it Lansing or Albany or Sacramento or whatever, the chances for people to have any idea of what's really going on are going to go down the drain almost entirely. I mean, the politicians don't have the impetus to be honest about what's going on, because it doesn't really serve their purposes in terms of getting reelected to shed light on everything they're doing. And the groups, the sort of lobbyists in this case, the Washington groups, that, you know, it's not always in their best interest to help tell people what's really going on either. If, for instance, the Human Rights Campaign is the largest lobby for the LGBT community. You know, they want to maintain a relationship, especially when they've got a Democrat in the White House, with President Obama. So if for any reason something he's doing isn't exactly in our best interests, and of course there are times when politicians are not doing what's in the best interests of certain constituencies at certain points. They can't always be doing, you know, but the thing that we want them to be doing. But if we don't know that they're not doing it, how can we put pressure on them to do it? And the Human Rights Campaign, for instance, would have good reason in some ways to try and maintain their relationship with the White House and not necessarily shed light on everything that's going on and put pressure on them publicly. So journalists, it's their charge to do that. It's their charge to find the truth. It's their charge to publicize it. That's what they're there for. In any political system, I just honestly believe that without a strong institution of journalism, there's no way that average people are going to get any idea of what's going on. So I just think it's scary to think that there might be, you know, downsizing at places like the Grand Rapids Press.
And Carrie, with that and some of your words that you said earlier, individual activism matters. What would you say is a final parting message?
Well, so I know beyond a shadow of a doubt that what I experienced over the 2.5 years the 2 years that I was in that briefing room and what I saw, what I covered, that people have the individual power to make a difference. And I'll give you an example. I mean, this is just one example. But when I was talking to one woman in Holland who was talking to the group there of progressive women, mainly in Holland, some LGBT folks, this one woman came up to me afterwards and she said, you know, my daughter, who is the light of my life, she got married to her partner, who's a woman, not long ago. And I made up, you know, took a picture, a wedding photo of them, and put a little border around it and wrote up a really nice note and sent it to all my local politicians to let them know that this was my daughter, that she was a part of our community, that I was proud of her, and that her love mattered just as much as anybody else's did. That is an individual piece of activism that everyone could engage in. You just have to be creative. You have to think about what you can do in your little corner of the world to make a difference. And you have that power. I'm convinced of it.
Carrie Elliville, national journalist, but back in Grand Rapids for a little bit of visit. Thanks for coming back to your hometown, spending a little bit of time on Catalyst Radio, and good luck as you journey on and work on that book.
Well, thanks so much for having me. It's been really a pleasure to be here.
Sunday morning, Saturday. I'm a simple woman, don't take much to make me happy. Just to have you here with me, just to share some of your sweet loving, baby, on early morning Saturday. You know it ain't happy when the sun goes down, and I get even better about 3:30. But nothing compares with the love we share on early morning Saturday. Hey, hey. My Saturday. You know it ain't happening when the sun goes down. I like it even better. Loving on early morning Saturday, my Saturday, my Saturday.
You have been listening to Catalyst Radio, your local public affairs radio program focusing on media issues and community efforts. We broadcast weekly. It's Fridays from noon to 12:30 p.m. on Community Media Center's radio station WYCE. Archives of Catalyst Radio shows can be found on our website at grcmc.org/catalystradio, as well as at our online citizen journalism site, The Rapidian. You can also find out about all the opportunities offered here at Grand Rapids Community Media Center at that site, grcmc.org. Audio editor this week is Matt Gerrels. I'm Linda Galash, and this is 88.1 FM WYCE, Wyoming, Grand Rapids.